You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
This episode of All the President's Minutes is brought to you by Bella Catering. BellaCatering.com.au is where you can find them. They're one of Sydney's best catering companies. And since the absolute gargantuan shit show of 2020 has descended upon us like one of those spaceships in Independence Day, and COVID-19 has changed our lives, these guys have pivoted from being one of the best face-to-face catering companies in all of Sydney to home delivery and creating just amazing stuff that you can order, you can take home, you can chuck in a freezer. And it's, why cook if you're going to have people over? I know that it's tough to even like think of having people over. You got to worry about hand sanitizers and temperature checks. And does this person have a mask? And really, is that relative of mine that clean? Do you want to invite them? Maybe you want to change it. Don't think about anything else except for that invite list. Order from Bella Catering. If you're in the greater Sydney area, they can help you. They're a great family business. They're part of our little family here at 18 Minute Productions. Thank you for listening. Now, onto the show.
I had all kinds of cute, humble things to say, and they're all gone. Somebody ought to mention Gordon Willis, who did an extraordinary job as cinematographer. I really do believe the acting level of the movie all the way through for a large cast was remarkable, and that's the work of Alan Pakula. And finally, this movie has been, from the very beginning, the obsession of Robert Redford. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Episode 84 is where we're at. The 84th minute of the 1976 masterpiece, collaborated and sort of mixed together by these incredible forces in Hollywood. One, the great Alan J. Pakula. Two, Robert Redford. Three, William Goldman. And just the alchemy of some of the best performers and tussling with a really critical historical moment and miraculously not screwing it up, which in hindsight is all the more miraculous. Today, I have a great guest who I've already had like a proto All the President's Minutes conversation with on his podcast, which was very exciting and which sort of laid the groundwork for us to talk today, which I'm really excited about. And this show never ceases to amaze me. The interconnectedness of people who are working and teaching and appreciating this text. He is a lecturer in English at Yale. For Australian listeners, that's important. It's in one of the most prestigious universities in the world, by far. He is a producer and a writer himself, has written for things like Law and Order Special Victims Unit, has had a couple of collaborations and pilots that have gone ahead. One called Sequestered, one called The Tap, has worked with one of his heroes. In his bio on Yale.com, they talk about working with one of his heroes, Rob Reiner, and I think of another person who has an unbelievable run and is deeply underappreciated, like Mr. Pakula, is that man, Mr. Rob Reiner. He is a writer himself and has a podcast, as I mentioned at the beginning, called To Live and Dialogue in LA. And if there's anyone who appreciates a pun-based podcast, it is me. It is my distinct pleasure to welcome Aaron Tracy to All the President's Minutes, mate. Thank you so much for being a part of the show.
I'm excited to be here. I love this show. I'm very excited to be here. And that intro made me think you should do a show on Reiner. How great would it be? You're right. He's underappreciated, but I would put his 9-year run, you know, from Spinal Tap all the way through, I guess it would be A Few Good Men, maybe The American President. That's as good a 9-year run as like any American director of all time.
It's really tough. Like that is a continual fun argument when you get your film friends around. It's like, yeah, who's had the best run? And a lot of people do the foot stamp of like, there's no better run than Coppola, Two Godfathers, A Conversation, to Apocalypse Now. And you're like, yeah, look, that's really good. Like, let's just ignore that for a quick second. And you try and find who's had those runs. And Rob Reiner's run, I mean, this is Spinal Tap.
It's amazing.
This is Spinal. Yeah. Just
first
that
movie.
Oh my God.
Can you imagine his first movie out of the gate?
No.
Walking into his office is humiliating because he's got all the posters framed on the wall. And it's just like, you feel like you're walking into like the Writers Guild because it's just like, oh, he has all the great movies. I was like, oh no, actually he made all of them in one decade. Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah, so I mean, they're special and then they're special. But yeah, no, like Pakula in this show, it just sort of starts to occur to you that like, there are some of these filmmakers who, for whatever reason, just seem to escape the acclaim because they maybe have a run and then they sort of dip out. But holy dooly, that 9-year run, as you said, he's a high in your draft picks if you're a sporting person of like who's ever had the best run in cinema, like because
yeah,
that many stone cold classics in a row of a variety of genres, you're just like, that is a very eclectic personality too, to be able to flex those different muscles. Cause Spinal Tap is such, I mean, so organic, so like just being in the moment, the entire script is like, you know, different. And as you said, all the way to the American President, like Sorkin talks about the 300-page script that he had for The American President. He ended up reusing, you know, all of the discarded bits for what would later form the pilots to The West Wing. So it's all
and
there.
There's a real, yeah, there's a big connection to our show, our movie today, actually. The original script for All the President's Men was going to star Robert Redford. Redford was going to play the president. He was going to be this sort of romantic hero. What Rob told me is that originally it was going to be much more sort of political heavy, not super different from All the President's Men.
Yes.
And then as they sort of, winnowed down the script from Sorkin's 300-page opus to what it became much more sort of romantic comedy, and Redford bowed out and he, you know, it went to Michael Douglas, of course. But, you know, my understanding is that Redford had a huge role that he played in the sort of the genesis of the script, the initial ideas. I think he might have been his idea to begin with, and he brought it to Rob.
Unbelievable, because in the like blooming research of the show, I feel like it's just never ending rabbit holes you can go down. It's like, I just love watching. I did a watch of Presidents backed up by The Candidate, which I'd never seen, only about a month ago, and just watching Redford explore the nooks and crannies of like this intersections of politics genre. And so you see him on the, you know, I guess behind enemy lines, if you're talking about it from an All the President's Men point of view, as a politician who kind of goes in, has to buy into his own BS. And then you get these great, like absolutely great scenes of him, like just spouting all of this rhetoric and he doesn't believe it. And then when he actually gets elected, spoilers for a movie that's now essentially 50 years old, but when he actually gets elected at the end of the movie and Peter Boyle's his like political advisor, he's like, holy shit, what do I do now? And it felt also very similar perhaps to the current leader of the United States, which is like, holy shit, I'm here. Now what do I do?
Right.
And terrific and very interesting, because again, another titan of this era, Martin Sheen, then goes on and does the West Wing,
right.
and takes that role, and it's like, well, there's one of this era's guys who's like, oh, this is a meaty, chewy part. I can have a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, I love all those 70s Redford movies, which you're right, which are really about something as opposed to most movies today. He had so much to say in that little trilogy he did with Downhill Racer also in The Candidate, where he was trying to sort of deconstruct, you know, what it means to be a public figure in America, what it means to be a politician in America. I got to say, though, just thinking about him in the context of All the President's Men, obviously I'm still a giant fan, but it leaves a bad taste in my mouth knowing, you know, that he claims that he basically wrote the screenplay.
Yes,
that hubbub. I assume you've talked about it on other episodes of the podcast.
I think it's something we can retussle with. I've had a few Goldman fans on who've defended it, but we're in the 84th episode, and I don't think we've talked about it in depth for a little while. So I feel like if this is your first episode, welcome. But it is something that I personally wrestle with, because I'm like, it's just not true.
It's not true. And there's a great article in the Writers Guild magazine where Richard Staton goes back through all the drafts of William Goldman's scripts that are in the library at the WGA, and basically proves that William Goldman wrote this script. The sort of the controversy came about when I think it was Vanity Fair published an article where Redford basically said, you know what, we threw out William Goldman's script, and me and the director basically holed up in a hotel room with Hoffman coming in every once in a while, and we just completely tore apart the script and rewrote it.
Yes.
And that's not true. I mean, my guess is a lot of actors, and Redford is obviously so much more than an actor. He's a producer, he's a creator. But so many actors feel like if they add a line or change a line, then they are co-authors of the screenplay. And they don't realize that it's Goldman's architecture, it's Goldman's building of the creation of the character, building of the character. That's what the screenplay is. So once you have all that in place, yes, an actor can make up as many lines as they want. It's still not theirs. Still, they're only able to perform that because of the screenplay that's there. And again, you know, Redford is, he's a legend. He's one of the greatest actors, producers of all time. So I don't know if that is what happened, but something got him very upset about, Goldman having credit on this film and him not having credit.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And it's one of those things that you can, it reeks of the bitterness of a friendship that fell apart, which is actually true, you know, and it feels like if that come off better, it'd been like, well, you know, you obviously, and I think every director and you yourself as a creator know, it's, and for folks who are listening who don't know, like the script is a great scaffolding. Like it gives you the design. It is literally the structure that you go by. And then when you are inspired by any given moment, things happen. And, you know, that's why we credit there's some movies that are so honed in on a particular voice. And like Tarantino is a guy that's like this. It's such honed in on his voice and everything about it. And he composes every shot that, you know, vulgar or tourists like myself are like, you get off on that because it's like, there's a guy so singular in his vision that everyone else is just compliment. He's just there to support it. The inverse of that is something like All the President's Men, where you can clearly see it's Redford being a driving force as producer. He's an incredible presence as an actor. It's Pakula's inspiration and working with really fastidious sort of workmen like behind the scenes people, whether it's the people who designed the film or whether it's Willis, you know, there's a whole crew of people there that are just finding inspiration in spaces, filming in, you know, Judy Hoback Miller's house as in the scene that precedes this and all those sorts of things. But Goldman's script is so important. And we were just talking in the run-up to even recording about Sam Wasserman's incredible book, The Big Goodbye, about the making of Chinatown. Yeah. And you can't make Roman Polanski's Chinatown, even though, you know, the draft that he submitted to Polanski in the beginning, you can't make that really tight and honed down 120-page script without what started out as like a 600-page treatment and then went down to 330-page script that you can then trim away and hone to the singular vision of that director. Like you can't, can't make up what he did. He built an entire world, and then they chose a perspective on that world. And I feel like that's...
Robert Towne did, yeah.
That Robert Towne did for Chinatown. And I think that William Goldman creates the voice. And then I think how the chemistry of the movie works, and with these, especially Hoffman and Redford playing off each other, it might be that's a Bernstein line. No, we'll flip it. That's a Woodward line. You just give the delivery differently. This will be a Bernstein line. They were, you know, learning each other's lines to be able to organically jump in. And it's like, yes, they made it sing, but William Goldman.
It's a Goldman joint. Yes, for sure. I'm the biggest William Goldman fan. Yeah. You know, it's also just the idea for the structure is William Goldman's. And I would argue that the structure of this movie is, you know, I put it up with any screenplay of all time. 9 out of 10 writers who attack this material would do it in a completely different way. You know, for one thing, they would take the ending way past where it is. The fact that we don't get to see, the fact that we never meet our antagonist, that is a truly crazy choice. Imagine going into a studio and saying you're going to make, you know, any kind of movie, an action movie, whatever, suspense, and you're never going to meet your antagonist. That's a revolutionary kind of idea. And that's exactly what Goldman does here. And then the idea is we never see our antagonists brought down. We never see the fruit of the labor of our heroes. But you don't need it. And Goldman does such a good job just sort of bringing us on this, you know, really exciting journey, this character study of these two guys who are revolutionaries themselves and who are changing the world. Almost any other writer would have done it a different way. And I will just say about Goldman and Redford's relationship, it's all the more disheartening because Goldman very much gave Redford his break. You know, he wrote Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. Which made Redford a superstar, right? And so then they collaborated again together, whatever, it's 4, 5, 6 years later. And so it's just more disheartening to know the fallout.
And Goldman wrote very fondly of him a lot of times about, and when you read, you know, his big pictures and What Lie Did I Tell and his incredibly influential books, he's talking directly, or like the compendiums of all of his columns that he wrote. He talks with, like, when he's talking about what a movie star is, his role model in his head is, his shorthand is always that this guy's not Robert Redford, or they are,
right?
Or they are operating on the same frequency, but they're doing it slightly differently. And so, like, when he's talking about people like Tom Cruise and Will Smith and those things, like,
right,
you can't escape a paragraph almost without him going like, well, compared to Redford, because that's his proto, like, movie star producer. And, you know, there's inescapable, you know, comparisons that he gets. So it's just this weird thing, you know, it's one of those sort of, it's a tragedy for us fans. Cause it's like, it would be so much nicer if everyone just could agree that the alchemy, there's no single voice that belongs in this movie. In this movie, it does not belong. Like, I'm an auteurist to the bone as a cinephile. You know, the people like Saris and Kale, who, you know, basically wrote auteurist poetry into our brains, you know, like, that is like in my DNA. But this is a movie that is such an incredible alchemy that it is undeniable. Like, it's for me, if anyone's like, what's the example of a true collaboration in every essence, it is this movie.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's one of those things also that makes you think about the bigger picture. Goldman obviously has perhaps the greatest stature of any American screenwriter, any screenwriter of all time. If he was a first time or second time or third time screenwriter, first of all, maybe he wouldn't have come up with this brilliance, but also Redford would have won that battle, you know, going away, running away with it. So it's like, you think about how many times this has happened where an actor or producer, you know, throws a writer off a project or just denigrates him to the point where people no longer believe that the screenwriter is actually responsible for the product. And we never hear about that screenwriter again. Goldman, luckily, is such a big deal. And, you know, speaking of Rob Reiner, I think Goldman is the only writer to write multiple Rob Reiner movies, right? He wrote The Princess Bride and he wrote Misery. And he's the mentor to Aaron Sorkin, who wrote All the President's Men and A Few Good Men. So Sorkin's another writer who wrote 2 for Rob, actually.
American President and A Few Good Men. American President and A Few Good Men, sorry.
Go ahead.
Before we dive into the minute, that, you know, just about that collaboration is like, I always want to give him a shout out when we can talk about it. Academy Award winning George Jenkins, who did the production design of this movie. Robert L. Wolfe, who you know, since talking to John Borson, who was Alan J. Pakula's assistant on All the President's Men in episode 76, if you haven't listened to it yet, it's one of my favorites of the series. You must listen to it. One of the things he talked about is exactly what you talked about just now, Aaron, which is like they had original, one of the things that when they were in the editing room in sort of the, you know, the poetry of having Nixon arrive in on the helicopter, you know, one of the original cuts that they did of the movie, they tried a moment with the archival footage of Nixon leaving on a chopper at the end. And so that you would have this moment of Nixon arriving on the chopper as at the beginning of the film and him leaving at the end. And it was Robert L. Wolf, who was a Republican and a protege in the Sam Peckinpah School of Editing. Like he edited on the teams that did The Wild Bunch and, you know, those sorts of films. And it was Robert L. Wolf going, nah, it's too on the nose. Finish with the teletype. You don't need to, like, oh, it's man. Like that is, so when you think of the great architecture of this movie and the great design of Jenkins and the great acting and all those bits, it's a moment that's sitting there with Pakula and his editor in the end, in the suite and going, it's too much. Take it out.
I love that. That's and a great, wow, like, that's a great tidbit.
That's just such a great, for me, that's like, you know, and Robert L. Wolf then is not going to say, I made this movie what it is today. You know, like it's just like they had the right people all together, all these different chorus of voices, and they just harmonized perfectly. And right now we've got one of the funnest scenes, which couldn't smack more of William Goldman's brilliance. These singing the music of a William Goldman movie. This is his, you know, it's the buddy cop formula that's been ripped off since Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And it's the same with these two guys. If you are watching it now, it is 1 hour and 23 minutes on the dial. It's the 84th minute. It goes up to 1 hour, 24 minutes on the dial. Aaron and I are going to watch together right now. You guys are going to listen along. And then we're going to unpack this beautiful, snappy repartee and the manic, chaotic, beautiful energy of Hoffman and Robert Redford's Woodward trying to just catch 1,000 ideas a minute on this typewriter. And it's just brilliant. So enjoy it. And we'll be back in a minute to talk about it.
So what do we got? Where is that? Where is that matchbook?
Here. LP and M.
Okay, LP and M.
L could be LaRue. It could be Liddy.
L is Liddy.
How do we know that?
Because she said it. Right here. She said at the time of the break-in, there was so much money floating around that I know that Gordon got part of it. So I said, you mean Gordon? Liddy, she said, yes. So L is Liddy.
Right.
Okay, that leaves P and M.
P could be Parkinson. It could be Porter. It could be...
Wait a minute. There was a guy that we talked to last week. Didn't he say that there was a Bart Porter who at one time was a member of the committee to re-elect?
Porter was called before the grand jury investigation.
So P is definitely Porter.
P could be Porter.
P is Porter, L is Liddy, that leaves... Right. That, all that leaves is M.
M could be McCord. That's out. It could be Mardian. It could be Magruder.
I think it's Magruder.
I think it's Magruder, too. Why do you think it's Magruder? Because he was second in command under Mitchell. Why do you think it's Magruder?
I think it's Magruder because at one time he was a temporary head of the committee to re-elect before.
Tragedy of this show is cutting off great scenes somehow.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful tragedy. God, I love that minute. And I love the I love things. Wait a minute. I love that. I love him going, Hoffman smiling at Redford going, what do you think it's Magruder? Like, and that it's just, this is just, I've said it a few times in some of these episodes, it is just music. It is, these guys are just, I love scenes like this. The great Clay Keller, who's part of the Vidiots organization, who joined me in the last episode, said this is the His Girl Friday moment of this movie. That's how much it bounces off each other. I just love this scene. I want to dive into why you love this scene.
Yeah, it was fun. I watched this a couple times last night getting ready for this, and I was surprised at how many sort of notes I made on the scene. It's, you know, I mean, this is, like I've told you, I love your podcast because I just love the complete monomania of dealing with 1 minute at a time and giving it such importance, putting every minute of this movie on a pedestal.
Yes.
But I honestly, I would say you could... you know, do it with almost any movie. I mean, I think a lot of movies, obviously, we'd have to talk about what's wrong with the minute, and a movie like this, we're almost always going to just worship at its altar. But I just do love, you know, just focusing in on such a short period. You know, I talked before about the architecture of the movie. And I think I kept using that word because, you know, that's William Goldman's word. He says that screenwriting is closer to being an architect than an artist. And so this minute is a really good moment of, you know, just sort of building the architecture of the movie. In, you know, specifically, it very much reveals their partnership. Each one brings such different skills to the table. So that moment of Hoffman saying P is Porter, and then Redford says, you know, basically, hold on a second, P could be Porter. You know, each partnership, every partnership needs this, right? One guy's got to be inspirational and energetic, and he's making huge leaps forward, and the other one's got to be sort of a calm, steady presence who doesn't let himself get carried away by emotions. And that's just done so perfectly with P is Porter. P could be Porter. It's amazing. So good.
And the ebb and flow of the minute is so wonderful because you can tell the excitement and the charge of the dialogue makes them change personas almost in a strange way. It's like, because then the very clinical Woodward towards the end of the scene is like, M could be, no, it's McCord. No, McCord, that's out. And it could be, no, I don't think that. And then he goes, it's Magruder. And then he's excited. Right. And then in his own way, Hoffman has to do that reverse interrogation, but the energy's still all the same. Yeah, it's terrific for that. And I know this is a weird tangent to go on, but we've been talking about filmmakers who are, I don't know, like sage advice. And we talked about Goldman and the way that he just describes things. There is a terrific film which is coming out in only 2 days. And I've had a look recently of its brand new first time ever Blu-ray transfer called Night Falls on Manhattan. It's a Sidney Lumet movie from 1996 with Andy Garcia. Yeah. A terrific movie. The movie is worth more than the price of any admission to anything you could potentially see in a cinema for a director's commentary by one Sidney Lumet, the great director of Dog Day Afternoon, 12 Angry Men, Network. I mean, just those three, forget it, career over. You are in the pantheon. You're in the Hall of Fame. Like, and listening to Sidney Lumet, he said something and described editing. And this scene is so charged with editing in ways that other parts of this movie aren't. And Sidney Lumet said that editing is, you don't want to waste your editorial momentum. Making fast edits is a choice to build tension, to fire people up and fire the audience up. And in this scene, I love the bang, bang, bang. The editor, even in the early stages of this sequence, the pans are slow between the characters. It starts to speed up with Hoffman's speed. And as they are putting this together, Robert L. Wolf, as the editor and Pakula and designing the scene, is firing bang, bang, bang between either guy. And Willis is like anchored the camera in the same spot or two cameras that are following back and forth to make this work. And I just...
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
When Lumet says in that commentary of his own film, don't burn your audience out with the tension. Don't waste these editorial speeds for nothing. You're using it to really heighten an experience for the audience. I just watched this scene again after listening to that commentary recently and just hearing that wisdom and going, man, they so effectively use the tension. They do not waste it. They give you all of the satisfaction of the speed of it. And it's such a, it's subtle compared to other movies. And then you look at The Inverse, which is like an action movie, you know, the, you know, people who were influenced by like a Paul Greengrass, and they just waste, you know, they'll do 13 edits of Liam Neeson jumping over a fence, and you're like, this means nothing. It means nothing. It's not doing anything for me except showing me that Liam Neeson can no longer mount a fence without any assistance.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the trick they teach you in screenwriting school, right? About how to write an action scene, that it can't just be a cool stunt. It's got to be something that stems from whatever the character's insecurity is.
Yes.
And this scene, I would argue that this scene from All the President's Men is All the President's Men version of an action scene. You know, I mean, the typewriter is gunfire, right? It might as well be gunfire. And all the jargon that they use, you know, L is Liddy, P is Porter. We don't know who those names are, right? A casual viewer of this movie has no idea who Porter, maybe they know who Liddy is, but they certainly don't know who Porter is. But it's okay because, you know, you think about any war movie and there's so much military jargon, right? But we don't care, right? Because we get the gist. We get what we need to get from that dialogue, and we understand that something giant is happening, something scary is happening. And that's exactly what this scene is, which is one of the reasons I was so excited to talk about it.
Yeah, it's I just love it. And so that new lens that I'm taking on the editing, it breathes new life. The performances are terrific. And I feel like the beginning of the minute has some great holds of, like, especially thinking and pondering. And it's such a fine line, because I agree with you. There are so many times where people go, like, first time I watch this, I need to go to the Wikipedia page and actually see some of these names. So I don't remember them, but it's like, I want to know what happened. And I agree, because, you know, now that I've watched this so many times and consumed so much of research around it, it's like, it's second nature to me. But, like, I imagine this scene, like you said, it's, you get the gist, all the war jargon, police cop jargon. It's a 211. It's a, you know, whatever, you know, you didn't, that means nothing to you, but you just kind of catch what you need to catch. But just the choices, Goldman seems to know when he can get away with a heap of jargon that people don't understand, and then knows right in this moment where they're like, when they say Magruder, why do you think it's Magruder? Which, unfortunately, we just get cut off at the end of the scene, but it's like explaining who he is and why he's important and why he's another key figure. And it's just like, takes that just extra second to explain who he is as opposed to the Lydian Porters, because we maybe heard their name so far. But I just love that choice. It's apart from the fact of the way the scene flows, but man, it's good.
A helpful exercise I always find is thinking about how else the scene could have been written, right? I mean, this is a very expository scene in many ways, right? They're just trying to figure out, Dustin Hoffman, you know, in the last scene was with Jane Alexander, and he was learning a little bit about, you know, some of the figures that she interacted with. And so this scene could simply be the two of them, Hoffman and Redford, you know, in the newsroom. It could be them sitting on a couch. It could be set anywhere. And they're just sort of, you know, thinking, all right, well, you know, she gave me this piece of information, that lines up with this other piece of information. You know, the fact that they turn this into, like I said, an action scene with, you know, the typewriter working fast and furious. I mean, there's no reason for that, right? It doesn't have to get the article done in the next 5 minutes. And Hoffman jumping up and down, you know, from the couch, walking into the kitchen, grabbing food. You remember Hoffman in the previous scene had like 5 cups of coffee because he wanted to stay in the living room. So he kept asking for more and more coffee so he'd be allowed to stay. So he's just super high on caffeine, right? And so Goldman takes advantage of that by having him, you know, absolutely restless. And so, you know, the way you hide exposition like this in a movie, if you're as talented as Goldman is you create really sort of exciting visuals to go around it. And in this case, it's all of those things. It's the typewriter clicking, clacking. It's Hoffman, you know, being high on caffeine. And so running around, it's all of that. It's like a masterclass.
And we miss something that it's funny what moments emerge, because we, you know, we put every minute on of this film, as you said, and I love what you said, is like, we put it on a pedestal, but someone was like, I really am disappointed I don't get to talk about the cookie. Because the cookie is just such a funny, it is such
Can we talk about the cookie?
Please.
Really like to talk about the cookie.
It's so funny. It's just such a funny thing. We can cheat into the next minute. It's such a funny touch. Please talk about the cookie.
Yeah. Okay. And I, you know, I want to respect the parameters of the show, but you know, when I was watching this on HBO Max, it looked like it was literally at the 0-0 mark. At the end of 123. So I'm gonna take it. I would argue, I don't want a cookie might be my favorite line in the whole movie.
It's
fantastic.
It's so good because it's one of those moments where it's like, if they made that up and it wasn't scripted and it was just something that they found on the day, it's perfect. But like you said, everything you said is about, with an action scene, is about the insecurities and it's about their relationship. And here it's these guys going, it's Redford's insecurity is Woodward is, I don't want to jump to conclusions. And Bernstein's insecurity is that this story is going to get taken away. And so the action of the scene is like tempering those two things. And so finally, that little, have a cookie, here's a reward.
Yeah.
And he's like, I don't do this. Right. I don't do this. I don't have a cookie.
Yeah.
It's so funny. And I saw this earlier this year. It was one of the last in Australia, cinemas have opened up. So I've seen a few things since we've opened up, which we're lucky now in the year of COVID-19. But one of my earlier screenings in the year was seeing this movie, and that line gets a belly laugh in an audience full of people. They like, it gets a It gets a great laugh.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're right. It does come off like a throwaway line by Redford. And so it very well may have been improv'd. And again, I respect the hell out of Redford. If he improv'd it, he deserves full credit for it. He does not deserve credit for writing the screenplay because he improv'd that and Goldman put them in that position. But yeah, I think you're exactly right about it being sort of a symbol of a reward. You know, I remember my sister always used to sort of sarcastically say, if I did something well, she would say, you want a cookie? Like it's a reward that we all use for doing something well. And in this case, it works so well because Bernstein is sure that they just figured out who P is, but Woodward is not so sure. So it's like, no, I don't want a cookie right now. We haven't cracked the case. It's a perfect summation of what's happening in the scene. And it's also just, it makes the characters feel lived in. You know, we get the sense that Bernstein is the kind of guy that snacks and moves around and needs something to do with his hands and is like craving sugar and caffeine at all times. You know, that's just, it's the definition of who he is. And like I was saying before, you know, Woodward is the opposite. He's much lower key. Him saying, I don't want a cookie is basically like him saying, I don't want cocaine right now, you fiends. Like, stop it. You know, it's like, it's just the perfect, it makes them feel lived in. We understand who they are from that moment. And it says so much about their partnership.
And there's nothing like, if you ever work with anyone and, you know, whether it's co-writing a features together, co-writing on a website together, collaborating on a podcast, it's like, one of you is the relentless snacker and the other one is not.
Right.
And so then there comes to a moment where they're like, snack? And you're like, no. Like, it's such a deeply relatable thing. Like my, I'm like a sweet tooth kind of person sometimes. So like, I feel like if my energy gets up, I'm like, I could be the guy that's like just constantly snacking, doing 20 things. And then, you know, I think we all find our Woodwards and Bernsteins in ourselves, depending on how manic we are based on the excitement of whatever project we're working on. But man, I don't want a cookie. Yeah. It's so good.
And no, that's a great point about, you know, writing partnerships. And oftentimes you take on the sort of the role that you need to play. Like I used to write with my buddy Alex, and he would, whenever he got pessimistic or cynical about one of our projects, I would take on the optimistic upbeat role. And oftentimes we would switch places. In terms of snacking, I remember he would always come over and he would have like a popsicle. And so, you know, I love those popsicles. I would have them when he wasn't around, but like when we were working, I was the sort of more down to earth one of, you know, I don't need a popsicle right now. And he would consume them. We constantly shift those roles, change those roles depending on what's needed in a partnership. And you really do see that with Woodward and Bernstein here in just such a fun, cozy way.
And you know, this is a little bit behind the music of my show and this podcast. It's like, I feel like whenever I'm down, my wife knows that I'm down. And then like, I'll miraculously sort of be sitting on the couch pondering, maybe we're watching a movie or something like that. And then like, the snacks will come out, like a delightful, whatever it is, a nice biscuits and delicious biscuits and cheese or ice cream with, you know, something she's pulled together. It's like, oh, the snacks are out. Cause she knows, it's like, come on, let's get back, you know, let's get that energy up. Right. You're the snacker. And it's just those funny things and like you said, that's the truest like relationship. It's like, I feel like I'm probably way more the guy who goes and grabs the cookie and throws it to a friend and like, I don't want a cookie. I feel like I'm more that guy. And it's just, I don't know. It's like that, there's little flashes of humanity that are just so powerful, like in amongst all of this really perfectly and precise stuff is just little, that's a little flash of like memorable.
Totally. And I'm sure everyone can relate to this right now. I know I certainly can, you know, in COVID, that you and your partner take on very different roles. There are tons of times where I've been just deeply pessimistic and sad about the future, both about our industry, when movies are going to be made again, but just also about, you know, how many people are dying sadly in this country and how many people are out of work and struggling for money. And when I'm like that, my girlfriend will be much more optimistic and trying to make me feel better. Because if we were both that way, it just, we wouldn't be able to survive. So you always need that yin and yang.
And I feel like that's a reflex. That's a good reflex. If you've got great relationships and you've got really close friends, it's like sometimes you'll just see what they're missing. You know, I one of my best mates, they've been so busy. We had to reschedule this recording because he just had his brand new baby girl was born, and he's been so like manically getting things prepared at their house. And he came to my place like about a month ago, and he came down here and I plied him with booze and great food. And we watched Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And that's exactly what he needed in his life. You know, like I feel like it's just like you needed that in your life right now. Things have been stressful. People have been working really hard to like, you know, just doing what they can really in this environment. And it's just like, here's some booze, here's some nice food. And here's Brad Pitt wearing moccasins for 2 hours. This is what you need in your life right now.
Completely. You know, and getting back to the scene, you know, something you said made me think of this. I talk a lot in my class about how so many great movies and TV shows are actually metaphors for the writing life. You know, these are, this may be about journalism, but it's by a guy who just sits in his very expensive Carlisle, hotel room apartment. But all of us are just, you know, sitting around our apartments and or our houses and just writing all day. And so naturally we're expressing our existence, right? We're expressing what we're doing through the characters, through the world that we're writing about. So, you know, in class we talk about examples like Mad Men, you know, which is all about creating ads. Breaking Bad is all about, you know, creating meth, they are both in their own way about creating TV.
And some would argue that Breaking Bad, the meth creation is actually more structured, because if you've watched Don Draper, it's like ply yourself with booze, try and find inspiration, and it happens like the muses. You know, it's almost like you can't even grasp it. Like it's like a gas where the smoke is slipping through your fingers. Wherein, you know, there's something scientific about Walter White's, you know, like I will structure this. I'm going to make this as precise. I'm going to do it.
Yeah. And I'm sure that represents the different writing styles of Gilligan and Weiner also.
Yes.
And of course the mentor apprentice relationship, which is just so common in TV, you see very much with Peggy and Don in Mad Men and Walt and Jesse in Breaking Bad. But here, you know, this scene especially is a perfect metaphor for the writing life. You know, Bernstein walks in and he is going through his notes, right, from the previous scene, from all the research he did. And he's trying to what's he doing with those notes? He's trying to come up with a coherent narrative, right? I mean, that is exactly, you can just imagine Goldman going through his notes on All the President's Men that he took on the book, All the President's Men, that he took in his research, you know, from talking to people at the Washington Post, and he's trying to create a coherent narrative. And then, you know, you pull back in the scene and what's on the wall? It's a giant corkboard filled with note cards. And that's exactly what a writer's room looks like.
Yes.
You know, just tons of notes on these cards or whiteboards now, just filled with ideas, filled with structure ideas, filled with scene ideas. This scene is, you know, they're talking about how to figure out, you know, who the different players in the Nixon administration are, how to link them to Watergate, but it just as easily could be about how to write a screenplay.
Yeah, and also just like, especially Goldman, because he's got that background as a fiction writer from the very beginning. You know, taking a note on a matchbook and taking a note on a napkin, and maybe him even just hearing the stories of how Carl would like assemble that and be his sort of organized disorganization, if you like, the way that I think that that's really relatable for anyone who's written fiction, because like there's sometimes, you know, you go for a run or you go for a walk, and you know, if you don't sprint home and like pour out that blistering clarity that you had about like how I'm going to structure this next project or how I'm going to do it, it just runs away. I don't know how to describe it other than that.
Yeah. Right. So I always think about this kind of thing, you know, we see a few times in this movie, Woodward and Bernstein, you know, just pulling notes out of their pockets. Notes are such a big deal. You know, the notes you took on a phone call, the notes you took while you were out. And to me, you know, I try to be so meticulous and orderly. Those notes would drive me absolutely bananas because they look like an insane person's, you know, sketching. What I do when I come up with an idea, and I often come up with my best ideas when I'm biking through Manhattan or just out somewhere moving, because moving really helps, you know, stir the hippocampus, whatever it is. I come up with ideas moving.
I can't explain it either, but a few ideas of like long form, you know, critical pieces and things like that came together with such blistering clarity. And like, I wish I'd used the voice memo, God damn it, but I didn't have my phone on me. I just had my watch. I was running with my Apple Watch. And so I, you know, had my headphones in my ear and I was like, man, if I could record a voice memo right now, I would.
Yeah. So that's what I do. So I just take out my phone and I pull up voice memos and I record something. And it could be as simple as this is a fix for the problem I'm having in Act 3, or this is a great line of dialogue I just thought of. And then I transcribe them later when I get home. And then it's also just a really fun kind of archive. You know, I can go back into my voice memos and I can listen to something when I was walking on, you know, 13th Street and 6th Avenue in Manhattan, and I came up with the closer for the teaser of the Law and Order episode, you know, and that's just kind of fun. And it's like, oh, okay, I, you know, my dumb self just walking around coming up with that idea. And then, yeah, later it's produced on TV. Like, that's just a fun little time capsule.
And there's so much of this that, you know, I think some people say, you know, they're like, oh, you can't make things like this. I'm like, I would totally be in for the journalism movie or journalism TV show, procedural journalism TV show, like these guys, like in the trenches in 2020. Like, I would be personally up for it. I think like the voice memo life, the, you know, having to transcribe things, you know, far away, having to nail an interview, having to get a photo, having to, you know, acquire different sources, and having contrary media outlets that seem to like they're operating as their own propagandistic arms that are fighting against you.
Yes.
I feel like that's the show. It's like, what does that look like now? Like, what's it like fighting in the trenches when you're writing for the Times, the New York Times, or the Post or something like that? And then for the next week, you know, Fox News is, you know, plastering some personal story about you to discredit the story. You know what I mean? Like, it feels like to me like that could be that's a ripe ground that feels unexplored.
Yeah. You know, that's one of those ideas that gets pitched, you know, every year, and I've never been able to understand. My friends and I all talk about why there's not been that one perfect journalism show in the same way that there are 15 hospital doctor lawyer shows. My oldest and closest friend is this guy, Sam, who works for the New York Times, and he has so many great stories about, you know, compiling stories, you know, interviewing, I wanted to say witnesses, but just interviewing people for their stories, sources, I should say. The sort of conventional wisdom in Hollywood is that the stakes are not high enough. And, you know, with lawyer cop doctor shows, you have people's lives on the line. I would argue you could find a way to make people's lives on the line with journalism also, especially in the age of fake news and the age of Trump. But I think that's always been the fear among executives, that viewers would not be able to understand the stakes if you don't have something as big as Watergate every week. You know, it's been tried a couple times, you know, Newsroom, obviously that was about TV news, which is a different kind of journalism. And I don't really think that show particularly worked. Shonda Rhimes has a new show for Netflix that may work. But someone will crack it. In the same way that there was the conventional wisdom was you cannot have a show about politics before The West Wing. And then The West Wing blew that up. And then 2 years ago, there were no less than 6 shows that took place in the White House. someone will crack the ceiling on journalism, and then there'll just be, you know, a dozen journalism shows.
I mean, if you're talking about danger being the metric of the unanswered question in previous years' pitches, it's like you only have to go to 2020 to find journalists as being assaulted and arrested on the streets. And it's like,
yes,
guess what? We just found a way to make it dangerous to be a journalist again. And when you're reporting on like malfeasance, and, you know, I feel like people have short memories, you know, because you and I are fans of older things. It's like journalists were always getting bundled up by corrupt policemen in every one of the great like detective movies. Yeah. Like journalists are not welcome to cast their light on it. So it feels just like, it's just like someone just hasn't pieced together how an arc is going to go. Look,
yeah, completely.
Aaron, it's an absolute treat talking to you. We've talked for many hours now on podcasts. It's so good. And I'm so glad that I got you on the show. And I when I say that, I don't know if I say it enough, but I'll say it now. It's like the fact that the show resonates for people really means something to me. And the fact that it means something to you and it resonates with you is all the more, makes me all the more chuffed. So I'm just really appreciative of your support and thank you for reaching out again and inviting me on your great show and being a part of this show.
Yeah, no, I mean, I said this a little bit on my podcast with you, but I just think this is one of the coolest ideas for a podcast I've ever heard. And part of it is because you're clearly doing it for just the love of the movie. Like it, you know, listening to your shows, it very much sounds like you would be talking about every minute of these movies, even if you didn't have a podcast. You know, you would be just at a bar or at a coffee shop, you know, boring your friends or, you know, dragging your friends into it. And the fact that you've assembled this really cool infrastructure to do it in an exciting, compelling way, I just think it's what podcasts should be. The passion comes through. I think it's so cool.
Oh, thank you so much. And literally, that is the what do you call it, like the inciting incident of my life, is that my friends got so sick of me talking about Heat. They're like, just do a podcast like about it or something. Shut
that's
up
awesome.
Like, and so that's how it started, and then obviously bloomed into this show. And truly, you know, I feel like, you know, you I think you were kind to say absolutely every movie could have a minute podcast. In my mind, there are certain ones that do not stand up to the scrutiny because they just don't have the perfection. I continue to marvel at like movies like Presidents because there is just not a wasted second in every minute of this masterpiece. And unpacking it every time with new great guests like yourself, I'm waiting for the minute that I'm bored, and it just literally never happens. It just never happens. We're like nearly 90 minutes into the movie, and I've just been compelled and moved by like every single part of this movie, every selection. It's just it's top shelf.
I gotta say though, the end goal, just like the platonic, you know, ideal version of this show, is someday you do, you know, every single minute of like, I don't know, Summer Rental or Weekend at Bernie's or, you know, some just crappy 80s movie.
Weekend at Bernie's might get me because I'm such a fan of how bad that movie is. I would be all in for that. But you know, look.
Call me. I'll do my minute. I'm ready.
You'll do it, and every other person I call will be like, "Nah, I'm good." So it'll be like 90 episodes. You'll be the only guest that comes up once for 1 minute, and maybe twice. But yeah, no. Look, thank you. That so many other projects that people know about on this show that are coming up, and yeah, not everyone deserves the minute by minute. Not all of them are going to get it in some of our future projects. We're going to do some short form ones and deep dive in a shorter form way, but oh man, this movie just keeps it rewarding. So thank you so much for doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, in terms of, I do the same thing with my podcast. It's really, I do it just because I love it, and it's a chance to talk to my guests. Like normally I've had guests like Ron Howard and Nancy Myers and Michael Douglas, and I don't have access to those people in normal life. I don't get to hang out with them, and so getting to invite them on to Live in Dialogue in LA, like that's the way I get to talk to them. And so it's you know, there's nothing better. Without this sort of podcast I would say resurgence because they feel a little bit like old radio plays, but it also is very much a new form. I don't know what I would do with my time.
Well, I can find
more energy.
I can share that with you, but that's look, it's been great to talk to you. Thanks for being a part of the show.
You too.
Aaron Tracy, what an absolute gentleman. What a great, wise approach. I could talk to Aaron for hours. At Aaron D. Tracy, with no E, T-R-A-C-Y, on Twitter if you want to follow Aaron. all the details about Aaron, as in his career as a executive producer and screenwriter and an optioner of great source material to produce into TV or movies, is in the description of the show. His terrific podcast, which I'm so like flabbergasted to even be asked to be a guest, To Live and Dialogue in LA, is wherever you get your great podcasts from, so do that. Thanks for listening to All the President's Minutes. We have a banger of a week for you. I am at One Blake Minute, at ATPM Pod, to follow the show on Twitter. Both of those are Twitter. One Blake Minute also on Instagram. If you want to also think about doing our Patreon, it's patreon.com/OneHeat Minute. Thanks so much for listening. We have an epic week. Enjoy the show.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.